No. They could be petals of. It could be circular, as far as I know. It could be offset so that it's square instead of diamond. You do need to have the silver on one side and the black on the other.
KD2WOT.
Yes, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, that's a kind of a great toy. I think the original thought was that the light, you know, that the light was actually pushing against the white, and that's what was causing it to rotate. That was the original.
You are quite right. Now, when I first heard this story, I said to myself, gee, this is the early 1800s. How the heck would anyone know that light pushes things? Because, you know, the way that I know that light pushes things, it's inside Einstein's equation, you know, E squared equals MC squared squared plus PC squared. So that's where momentum is equal to energy and where massless objects can still have momentum. But I said to myself, how the heck did 1800 people have the idea that sunlight pushes things away? So my next question is, how do you think they thought that light pushes stuff away?
Well, actually, I don't believe that's how it works. I mean...
No, it doesn't, but the principle is still sound. So I just wanted to, as a little side note, wonder if people could guess or know what gave people an idea in the 1800s that light had a pressure to it.
I guess when you shine the light against a mirror, you know, and it bounced back, I mean, you would think that there was maybe something powerful there.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
The one that you have on your website, is that the one that they had in the 1800s? Because if that's true, they probably figured, well, the light is being reflected from the shiny object, the silver object, and it's being absorbed by the dark side. So they probably thought that the silver coating, the light was bouncing off of it, pushing it.
Well, yeah, but they started with the belief for more than 100 years before then that light produces a force. Before Crookes built his radiometer, I think he was building the radiometer to get that kind of effect to measure and such. So they already knew, in the 1700s, or they thought that they knew, that light pushes against things. So I just wonder if anyone could come up with some example that the people in the 1700s would recognize as the sun pushing against something.
Did that globe in the 1800s have a vacuum? I mean, those people knew how to pull a vacuum. Wow.
Well, that's the curious thing. The way the Crookes radiometer worked is if it had no vacuum at all, it didn't work. But they were able to pull a decent vacuum. When they really pulled a very good vacuum, it didn't work. They finally, Crookes found out that he had to have approximately one-tenth of an atmosphere in the bulb to get it to work, which again makes people suspicious of how it works.
Well, it is a heat engine. One side is silver, right, or white, and there is a temperature difference that makes it move.
Okay, but you're kind of answering the wrong question. The question that I was curious about at this point is why people from the 1700s thought that the sunlight repels things, that pushes against it.
I don't know, but Stirling engine, I believe in somewhere in 1800s, there were people who were doing the pre-Stirling engines, and they were working. So then from that, we have a locomotive that is that was powering the rail wagons for 150 years before it took over by the gasoline. But anyhow, my understanding is that since they find out how to make a partial vacuum, then they start to experiment, and it was a pure accident. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, I'm not really familiar with the very early history of producing vacuums. I'm trying to get people to think on the subject of why you would think that light can push against things. Because, again, to me, it makes perfect sense after Albert Einstein finished his theory of relativity. It's in the equation. But hundreds of years earlier, there were no equations, and certainly Isaac Newton didn't really do any particular work on the pressure of light. So, once again, the question I'm trying to get answered is why anyone thinks that in the 1700s, people saw something that gave them the idea that that light produces a pressure. That you know, where would they see that?
And light.
Yes.
NY2H.
Okay, first Lou, then Sam. Lou?
Just a guess, but maybe a prism or a concave or convex mirror.
Okay, I'll get back to that in a second. Sam, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, doesn't light cause heat and heat expands and can move things?
Okay, but that requires it moving against something. So if you were in a vacuum, the same reason, if you took the Crookes radiometer and you pumped out all the air and you shine the brightest light you can find, the Crookes radiometer would just sit there. So something else is going on. The answer to at least Crookes radiometer is it never was really a radiometer. It was a heat engine. And as people have suggested, what's going on, what was thought to go on later on, is that the black part absorbs the light, heats up. The heat then heats up the air on the surface of the black area, and its increased temperature is increased kinetic energy, and so the atoms bouncing back and forth would impede a little bit of a push, whereas the mirrored portion would absorb less of the light and less of the heat. Later on, they figured out that the heat differential wasn't enough in the middle of the plate, and it was an edge effect of the plate, that the heat being absorbed at the edges of the black portion were heating the air and producing excited gas molecules at one-tenth of an atmosphere and pushing the Crookes radiometer. So the problem initially with the Crookes radiometer is if you figured out where it would spin, if it was really a radiometer that was affected by light, it would spin in the opposite direction because it's a case of elastic and inelastic collision. In the mirrored collision is elastic and produces more momentum than the black, but it's the black that seems to be pushed away from the bright light. Plus the fact that if you put a cold compress on your Crookes radiometer, the radiometer will start to spin in the opposite direction until the temperature equilibrates. Let me drop. So the Crookes radiometer has been known to be really a heat engine. The thing that I was kind of wanted to know if people could figure it out is people have been looking at comets for before the 1600s, and if you notice what happens with comets, the tail is opposite the sunlight. So they came to the conclusion, because they didn't know about solar wind, that it was the light of the sun that was pressing on the comet's tail and producing that that direction of the tail.
Zero Delta 2, Zulu Alpha November.
Yes. KD2ZAN, you want to say something?
Yes, I've finally been able to get on this repeater. I've upgraded my equipment a little bit. Good evening to everyone on the net, by the way. So I've been relying on the chat extensively, but now I'm finally able to hit this thing. Good evening, everybody. My name here is Paul, my QTH is Brooklyn, New York.
Okay, very good, Paul. I'm glad to hear you. I've read your stuff in the chat room for the last few months, and I'm glad that you were able to hit the repeater, and I look forward to future participations from you.
Thank you, Roy. Appreciate it. I'm going to step into the background for a while.
Okay. So basically, because in Newton's time they didn't know about solar wind, they put two and two together and they came up sort of with 22. But they were right. There is a radiation pressure. It's just the Crookes radiometer was not a radiometer. It was a heat engine. So let me ask you now, how do you think the Nichols radiometer works? Yes, Leslie?
The actual pressure exerted by light is far too small to move to the veins, but it can be measured with devices like Nichols radiometers. I'm reading, so it's not that I'm that smart, actually, but it says that Nichols radiometer was the apparatus used by Ernest Fox Nichols and Gordon Fourier Hull in 1901. So we're talking about two centuries past for the measurement of radiation pressure. It is consistent of the pair of small silver glass mirrors suspended in the matter of a torsion balanced by fine quartz fiber.
Okay, very good. So the bottom line, the whole point of the exercise is that a Nichols radiometer is actually a radiometer. It actually does measure radiation pressure, which is very, very weak. Dick used to love to have discussions about light pressure and solar sails. Soon Paul will tell you a story about a new technology. The old solar sails were designed to be reflective, which had problems. Partially the silvered side would absorb something like 15 to 20% of the radiation and would overheat. It was a delicate, very large surface area device, and it was a pain in the backside to steer, and you had to tack the same way that sailors tack into the wind. You have to tack into the sunlight. So there was a lot of problems with the concept of a reflective solar sail. But they're working on a new technology, and hopefully Paul will discuss it, and I may return to put in my two cents worth. Any other questions before we call this portion of the net to an end?
Intuition.
Yes, Wesley.
Okay, I have a number of radiometers here, but they are specialized devices. Now, when you put next to it the isotopes, so let's say we have a sample taken from old smoke detector, that's the alpha particles, you can see it move. But you can have beta particles and you can have gamma. It's not a particle, gamma is a radiation. And if you have a source for it, the cesium-137, right? You can have it moved. So that was one of the first devices used by Madame Curie, who was Polish, when she was working on polonium. And she was given a Nobel Prize for it. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, radiometers are fascinating devices. Unfortunately, I couldn't even find a picture of a Nichols radiometer. They're so rare at this point because they were such delicate instruments and sophisticated. Whereas you could buy probably a dozen Crookes radiometers from some joint in China through Amazon for, I don't know, $20-$30. Again, I like my Crookes radiometer. I realize it's not a radiometer. It's a heat engine, but it still looks rather nice on my shelf. So I think we kind of did this, thankfully. It only took me 6 weeks, and I hope some people learn some things about light pressure, and you'll learn a little bit more later in the SpaceNet report. So thanks to everyone who participated tonight. It was a kind of a quiet night, but we got to the other end of it. So once again, thanks, and Paul, WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
One more comment.
Okay, Wes.
Do you remember those, how do they call them? The end of days? There were yellow radiation meters, and they became very much popular in general public in 50s and 40s. The yellow one, and they had something like a very small cylinder, about half of an inch in diameter, with the glass on it. Do you remember those?
No, that predates me. I assume it used the Geiger Müller tube.
Are you talking about a Geiger counter, Wesley?
That is correct. But they had a small devices attached into that system, and that was a small tube, long probably 3 inches or maybe 4 inches diameter. It wasn't even a half of an inch, quarter of an inch, and had a glass viewer in it. You could view through it, and you saw inside the small scale. Does anybody recall that? Okay, so each one of those, how do they call it? The last day on the Earth, if there is a nuclear strike. How do they call that, Dr. Roy?
Probably Doomsday, Wesley.
Right, Doomsday. So they were doomsday devices, and that was during a time of Iron Curtain and Cold War, and plenty of them. They were yellow in color. Those small tubes were like calibration devices for the rest of the device in the set. And they were radiometers, but then I end up with probably four or five of them. So if that would be a time, I'm gonna show it to you, or maybe send the pictures of it. Extremely sophisticated one from 50s and 60s, and even some of them from 40s. I got them for $35 from one of the universities in Ohio. On the auction, and when I got there, they were almost crying that I'm taking it. They were offering me three times more just to don't take them. But I couldn't resist. Enter exchange.
WB2EAB with an almost relevant comment.
Okay, very good, Ed. I just want to pass on the fact that all these things probably ran using what was called at one point Geiger-Müller tubes, otherwise known as Geiger counters. And I think Geiger was a real loathsome scientist, a real miserable creature, but nevertheless. Over to you, Ed.
All right, first, I believe the Geiger-Müller tube is a tube with some ionizable gas, and I'm not sure what it would detect. Like, you know, beta particles, I believe, will not pass through glass. Maybe, no, alpha particles will not pass through glass. Maybe beta particles, which are electrons, or something like that, that every time one passes through, the gas ionizes and conducts, and you get a click. And the rate of clicks was indicative of it. But an interesting thing, if one does actually get one's hands on an actual fully working Geiger counter, hold it near a pile of bananas, and you should be able to get a slight reading, a noticeable reading, because bananas are very high in potassium, which has radioactive isotopes, and they are very, very slightly radioactive, but it's enough for a sensitive detector to pick it up.
Yes, indeed. You know, thankfully, you'd have to have a ridiculous amount of bananas, and you probably suffer from potassium poisoning at that point, long before you'd get radiation poisoning. But yeah, the small portion. Every time that you eat a banana, there's antimatter being created. The way that the radioactive potassium decays is to produce a positron. So you don't have a lot of positrons in your stomach, but every so often you'll get a positron. So think about that. Geiger counter tubes, as far as I know, they detected the gamma, they detected X-ray. They also were able to detect alpha and beta particles. It depends upon how strong they are and how thick the shielding around the tube was, I think.
I would think you wouldn't want any shielding at all. You want to get the most you can.
Well, yeah, but I mean, they might have made them more selective for photons as opposed to alpha and beta particles under some circumstances.
Okay. My specialty is particle physics. Do you think that would be suitable for the technet? You can go to I don't know how many, plenty of devices. From the simplest one to a very much sophisticated one. We can go to that subject. So think about it and let me know.
Okay, Wes, but it's certainly time for the SpaceNet report. Sorry, Paul, for delaying it again.
Oh, no problem. I'm fascinated with these old tags that they used to use. Anytime we used to go to Brookhaven Lab, they gave us a tag, but I think it was similar to a regular X-ray type of material, you know, from the old days when they used to take pictures of your teeth. I mean, we used to go in there, and at the end of the week, we were supposed to turn these things in and find out how many REMs we got. Never did find. They never came back and told us, but I don't know. I'm not glowing now. All right, let me drop it. We'll start the SpaceNet report.
WB2EAD with a quick comment for Paul.
Hi, Ed. Go ahead.
There are several different types of dosimeters. Once upon a time, I don't know, about 10 years ago, before they shut down Indian Point, we got a tour of Indian Point. And they gave us two dosimeters for two subtle variations. And they're very commonly used in all kinds of things. Whenever you do anything with any kind of a nuclear facility whatsoever, they're absolutely mandatory and they're always checked. And like one of them is like short-term and one is like cumulative.
Oh, okay. Very good. Yeah. We did a lot of welding there. I was curious to see if all the welding I was doing, if it was going to, you know, some kind of radiation coming off of this, if it was going to accelerate the decay of this thing on the dosimeter. But like I said, we never got results. For all I knew, they probably just threw the stuff away. I mean, you know, everybody had them, but not being regular workers there, we probably we're not going to get results. You know, I'm sure all the scientists and everybody probably get results every week. I don't think they cared if we started glowing. Anyway, as far as... by the way, that's a great place to work, Brookhaven Lab. I mean, I wanted to chain myself in a column and never leave. It was a very interesting place. Anyway, Roy was talking about this new solar sail concept by NASA that's been actually funded now. The idea is to put up a solar sail for a spacecraft instead of the old-fashioned type with just, you know, like a Mylar, very thin material that would open up, and it would actually use the pressure of the sun, you know, not particles flying off the sun, you know, like on a, you know, anytime they have a corona burst of any kind. This is actually light. So, and they've done a couple of them before. Planetary Society has launched two of them. First one, they really couldn't have very good results. They were just happy to see if the thing would open up in space. Second one, it did show that it was eventually going to come back to Earth, but if you didn't have the sail, it would have came back early, and with the sail, it stayed in orbit longer, and it would change the direction, like Roy was talking about before. You would change the way the solar sail was, you know, when it was going around the Earth, you know, it would face, you know, the sun at one time, and then it would actually just, it would turn it, you know, 90 degrees one way or the other to try to keep this thing accelerating. And Japan also has launched a solar sail, too, but this is a different type. I mean, the shape is the same. It's a big, looks like a big square. But it has diffraction system, so there's a lot of little grates in this new system from this company. It's now going to be funded by NASA. It's like fine little grates, and it creates diffraction. So as light goes through these edges, you know, you would wind up diffraction on the ends, and they feel that will give them a lot more push than just, you know, it was just sunlight hitting the whole face of the sail. Actually, it would be going through it, and on the other end, by having all the photons separate like that, they feel that that's going to create more pressure. So it's an interesting concept, similar to our radio transmissions that we talked about here on the net years ago. You would have diffraction. Let's say you are transmitting in a 10 gigahertz contest. You're transmitting from, you know, one mountain to the other, but you know the one mountain is a little too high, but yet you're hitting the top of it, and that edge, you're creating that edge. It diffracts the radio signal, so now not only going over the mountain, but because you're hitting the edge, some of the signal is dropping down on the opposite side of that mountain. So somebody could be, you know, not line of sight with the transmitter, and yet pick up the signal on the other side of the mountain. You know, and that's diffraction. I think it's very similar to that theory. Any comments or questions? Well, okay, the diffractive solar sail project, anyway, went through phase one, now it's going through phase two, now they're actually going to go through phase three. Phase three is, this company is going to start assembling it, and they plan on eventually launching this thing into space by, I think they said 2025 or so. So it's only a couple of years away. They plan on developing it, constructing it, and hopefully they'll be able to do different things with it. They'd like to be able to do more polar launches of the sun, and this thing would would help dramatically. So that's a good first start for the test of this diffracting solar sail. They'd like to be able to go right over the poles. We've done it before with a spacecraft called Ulysses. Ulysses they sent out all the way to Jupiter and used the pull of Jupiter to change the inclination of the satellite. When, you know, went out on the equatorial plane, got out to Jupiter, and it, just as it starts to slow down, the way the angle that they come in on Jupiter went around the southern pole, and then it went around the northern pole, and then kept on going, and eventually went over the northern part of the sun. So that, you know, that was very successful, and eventually, of course, it went over the southern part of the sun. And so that, you know, with all the detectors and things that they had, the scientists were able to, you know, get a good idea of what's going on the poles. But they, you know, that was late 1980s or so when they launched Ulysses, maybe early 1990s. So they would like to do it again. And with these things, you could probably get there a lot quicker when they launch these things, because nothing's going to, you know, it's just going to be under constant pressure. You know, you really don't have to bring any fuel with you. All you need is maybe some types of gyros to, you know, keep yourself oriented in space. And your fuel is the solar sunlight, so that you can't beat that. And then, of course, it could be scaled up to larger payloads in the future. Any comments? WS2N.
KD2SCP, KD2SCP, standing by.
KD2SEP. Yeah, go ahead. My name is Paul, and the call here is WS2N.
Yes, my name is Lou. Like I said, KD2SCP. I'm located in Yonkers. I'm using the Woshin 4-band. I'm putting out about, 5-6 watts roughly. Back to you.
Okay, very good. You're doing good. You pull quite into the repeater. And what you've joined is the Sunday Night TechNet. We're here every Sunday from 8 o'clock to around 11:15. And we're up to the SpaceNet report. Toward the end of the net, we update the stories of what's going on in the world of space, all the different countries that are involved, the private companies that are involved, and how it relates to amateur radio. We try to get that in as well, Lou. And this net is run by Roy, AC2GS, and he'll be back later, after I finish. Back to you, Lou.
USCP, Lou again. So where are you actually located? Where are you transmitting from? And my screen's saying Oneonta. That's a good distance from here.
Okay, I'm in Ronkonkoma. So out in Suffolk County here. You can find us real easy on a map, Lou. Just we're about the only good sized lake on the island. Anyway, let's continue on with the net. Another launch that just went up last week is a mission called the Outpost Mars Demo 1 mission. Really nothing to do with Mars, but it was a test by this one company, Nanosystems, that wanted to be able to test cutting metal in space. The idea is to be able to actually
you know, actually cut metal, but without having any metal filings fly off in the vacuum of space. So they wound up going, you know, getting a contract with SpaceX. SpaceX launched a mission last week, which I think was around 40 or 50 satellites that went up from different companies, and even some different countries that are involved. That went for a ride on their Falcon 9 into orbit, Transporter 5 mission, they call it. Anyway, this was one of them, and it was, you know, attached to the main payload. The other 40 satellites are actually going to disconnect or have disconnected and gone to their orbits. But this particular demonstration mission was attached to the main payload. And right after they got into orbit, it has a small robotic arm on board and has a cutting tool. But the cutting tool is going at such a high speed that the idea is it was actually going to, I guess, melt the steel. There's three coupons that they bought up with them, and they're different types of stainless steel. Let me drop it. And they want to be able to see if they can cut this thing without any debris coming off. There's cameras, and they're going to check. And I don't have the results yet if it was successful. But if it is successful on any one of these three pieces of metal that they're going to cut, especially the stainless steel, is a stainless steel 316, which is the same material that they use on the second stage on the Vulcan rocket, which hasn't been launched yet. That should go on its first mission at the end of the year. The second stages are all quite large. You know, they're, you know, roughly 12 feet in diameter, and sometimes they're even a lot longer, maybe 12 by 40 feet. And they want to be able to use these as habitats. You know, you launch the second stage instead of firing the engines and having it deorbit over the Pacific, keep it in orbit. The idea is to send this robotic machine eventually to catch up with that second stage and actually cut it, you know, cut into it, and use that second stage, and, you know, put a doorway in it, whatever, you know, hatchway, and eventually use it for future habitats. You know, I mean, that's a long way off, but, you know, they got to start somewhere. So this company, has the contract and to do it, and they get funded, and hopefully it works. I just don't know how they're going to cut a piece of metal without having any kind of filings come off. I mean, everything I've ever used outside of a plasma torch, and even that, you know, that has debris coming off of it, you know, for cutting stainless steel. That, you know, it's supposed to be some kind of spinning wheel. I guess very similar to friction welding. That's what these companies are using now. NASA uses it for assembling their large tanks. SpaceX has been using it. You know, they use this high spinning wheel, puts a piece of metal essentially together, and you know, it creates heat, and then they eventually fuse together. And they say the welds are, you know, better than MIG welding or any kind of automated welding. So my guess is they're probably using something similar and just going right through the material and probably cutting through it. I haven't seen it yet. I haven't seen a picture of what it looks like, but when I do, I will bring it up on the net. Any comments or questions, WS2S. Nothing heard. Wesley brought up Starliner before. Starliner, we've been following on this net, seems like forever. You know, that was back in 2019 December when they first tried to get to the space station. They launched. remember talking to Dick about it. He was still around, K2RIW. And this spacecraft in 2019, December, launched on an Atlas V rocket, successfully got to orbit, and then had problems right after it because of software problems, timing problems. And the spacecraft thought it was somewhere else in space, so it kept firing its thrusters. Eventually started going low on fuel, and NASA pulled the plug, and they said, let's bring this thing back. And it successfully landed in New Mexico. It has these big airbags, and everything was fine, but it never made it to the International Space Station. Unmanned, uncrewed, but that was the first test, and they corrected those problems and eventually got themselves back to the launch pad. They were going to launch last August, but then they had other problems. They have these thrusters on board Starliner, 12 of them, and half a dozen at least were. They noticed at the beginning was the valves wouldn't open up, and they figured they out of all the thrusters is more on a service module. Anyway, they found out it was a total of 13 that were actually failed, and if they're not open at launch, they can't launch. So they were all in the closed position. They found out that there was some kind of reaction, some kind of like oxidation almost, with the nitrogen tetroxide that's on board the space station that they use as an oxidizer. Apparently, mixed with the high humidity of Florida, and it created a pitting type of problem on the metal surface of all these thrusters. So they canceled that. Anyway, they finally got off the ground a week and a half ago. Launched successfully on the Atlas V rocket, and eventually they caught up to the space station. They docked with the space station. We talked about this last week. Two astronauts went inside the spacecraft, opened the hatch. Those two astronauts happen to be amateur radio operators as well. So two hams were the first ones in the Starliner. By the way, Starliner is built by Boeing, and it's launched on the Atlas V. Atlas V is launched by ULA, which is a consortium between Boeing and Lockheed. So Boeing was very happy that they made it to the space station and made it back. 5 days later, after unloading 600 pounds worth of stuff, which they haven't bring up, which is really nothing compared to what a cargo vehicle would bring up, but this is a manned spacecraft capable of carrying at least 4 people to the space station, and maybe more in the future. And they brought back around 500 or 600 pounds worth of stuff, including these empty nitrogen tanks that will eventually be recharged and sent back up to the space station. They supplement the air up there. Although they recycle the air, they do supplement it and add to it whenever they can. So it came back, landed successfully in the New Mexico, White Sands, New Mexico desert, came through the atmosphere. Heat shield worked great. Three parachutes in this case, open up compared to the 4 parachutes that SpaceX uses. These happen to be larger to make up the difference. The goal is always to land at like 15, 16 miles an hour at the very end.
I have a question.
And then the heat shield separated on the way down. They have to get rid of the heat shield. 6 nitrogen-filled airbags open up, and that's what they land on. They come down on that, and that softens the blow. If there was a crew in there, it would hardly feel anything. With that successful mission, the next time it goes up, we'll have a crew. Presently scheduled for the end of the year, depending on the
on what SpaceX is doing. They keep bringing the crews up, you know, four at a time. They're staying now at 6 month intervals. They've done that four different times. But now Starliner will be in there, so that will separate the times. Because of that, if both spacecraft are going up and they're at 6 month intervals, you'll probably have one launch per year of each spacecraft to the International Space Station. And by the way, John on the chat room talked about seeing the space station tonight. And at 10:02, I just looked out the front door toward the west, and sure enough, I did see that. It was very bright. It was a magnitude 4.6, and it was roughly a 4 or 5 minute pass. I think the last time I got to see it was in the fall, and sure enough, I brought it up. I have the app that it's called the ISS detector, and that matched what John had, and it went like right over the house. And there's a lot of there's extra modules on there from the last time I saw it. The Russians have added the Nyoka module, and it was a pristine Bristol module on the bottom of that. I think they did that at the end of the year, last year. And then we have a Cygnus spacecraft, cargo spacecraft attached to it. You have a crew Dragon attached also to the Zenith port on a Hominy module, as well as a couple of Progress vehicles and one Soyuz crew vehicle. So it's a lot of not only mass, but it takes up a lot of like space. So the more space it takes up, the easier it is for us other things to see the space station when it goes up on a clear night and at the proper time. Just the sun is reflecting off of it, and even so, it's dark as anything down here. It's still bright as day up there, and eventually, sometimes they just blink out. They'll be going over the house. You think they're gonna go all the way to the horizon, but all of a sudden, blink, they're gone. it's always good to. It's always great to go out and look for that. And then if you have the capability of trying to contact them, you never know if they're on as well. Any other questions, comments before I move on? WS2N. I keep hearing King, but nobody there. The Psyche spacecraft has been delayed a little bit. Psyche is supposed to go up in August. Now it's going to go up the end of September.
That time complete.
And they have a couple of software problems with their computers. Psyche is going to launch to an asteroid under the same name, Psyche. And it's a hard metal type of asteroid in the asteroid belt. And they plan on getting there and eventually orbiting it with their Orion engine. Ion engine helping them get there, and Ion engine helping them put itself into around that asteroid. They've never investigated this type of asteroid before. That's why they chose to go on this mission. It's got very large solar sails. I think it's going to push out, 4,000 watts of power, 4 kilowatts. When it gets to near the asteroid belt, of course, it gets cut down quite a bit. But they have large solar panels on it. And one of the things I'm interested in, they're going to try laser communication with Earth. There's a lot of data that comes back. There's pictures and stuff, but there's tons of data that comes back from these spacecraft. And they use the Deep Space Network, which is presently involved with around 16 deep space missions. So they don't like to overcrowd that if they don't have to. So what will work is
transmitting on using light. You know, basically lasers are being sent back and received on Earth. You don't need the deep space network for that. As far as I know, they just have the one receiver in New Mexico. I guess if it eventually works out, I guess they could set up receivers and maybe transmit it in the same three locations that the deep space network is located in: Goldstone, California, Madrid, Spain, and Canberra, down in Australia. So I could see that happening someday in the not too distant future. Tremendous amount of bandwidth, speed, data that could be transmitted back down compared to RF. But we're looking forward to seeing Psyche go up. It's going to go up on a SpaceX Falcon Heavy. So if you remember seeing that, actually about 2 years ago, I think it was the last one, they would launch, instead of one Falcon 9 rocket, you have three Falcon 9 rockets, just bolt them all together, and one on the port side, one on the starboard side, and then launch this thing into space. That's what they plan on doing. And it's always something that usually makes the news, because the two side boosters always come back and landed and back at Cape Canaveral. They have landing zone 13 now. They built two pads, and they come down identically. It looks like animation the way they come down and land in that the exact same split second. The timing is just perfect. Four legs open up on both the craft, and hopefully they'll be able to salvage the one at sea. They haven't successfully done that yet. I think they've launched three Falcon Heavy so far, and each time they're unable to save that booster. They get better at it, they might be able to do that. Or they might just have it as an expendable vehicle. That, I think they did do that one time. They'll just let that go into the Atlantic Ocean. Okay, nothing heard. I have a couple of other topics, but we're getting past 11 o'clock. I'll just turn this back to Roy, and we'll cover the other topics that are that important. We'll just add that to the list of next week. Tomorrow night's the club InfoNet, so that always comes on at 8:30, and that'll be followed by Swap and Shop, and that's also followed by Newsline. Back to you, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do on the TechNet, and thank you for all that you do for the club. There's AC2GS out there, and I just want to thank everyone who participated tonight. It was kind of a quiet night, but I'm glad I had the opportunity to do my little spiel on radiometers. I tend to find them fascinating, and I hope you were interested as well. Thanks to everyone who participated. I hope you'll come back next week when we try and do this all over again. And I hope some people actually bring questions, because it would be nice to talk about antennas and radios and amateur radio, as opposed to stuff that isn't antennas and radios and amateur radio. But anyway, be kind to each other. Be well. Be safe. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other, because we're all in it together. And as my new favorite quote goes, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So, have a great week, and please come back next week and bring some questions or topics or comments. This is AC2GS calling the end of this Memorial Day weekend version of the Limar Technical Net, and I am clear.
KD2SCP, KD2SCP, standing by.
How you doing, Lou? This is again Paul, WS2N.
Yeah, we just, you're probably listening, so we just closed the net. Now the repeater goes back to normal operation. Back to you, Lou.
Hey, Paul, Lou. I'm actually located in Yonkers, so I'm not that far from you guys. You said you were out in Ronkonkoma. I'm picking you up on multiple channels that I have programmed into this radio. I guess a lot of them maybe duplicated themselves somehow as I was putting them in, but it's a Voshin quad band, and I've been using it for about 3 to 6 months now, just kind of getting used to it, and you got to manually program it in. You can't even use like a code plug or anything like that. It's all analog.
Okay, very good. Yeah, any new radios, it takes me forever to try to fool around with it. That last one I got recently was the Alinco, it was an HT, Alinco DJ500, and I went nuts reading the directions on that. But very good. Well, you sound great.
Believe it or not, I'm actually using a disc cone antenna. It's not even a J-pole or anything like that. But I'm having a real headache with my ICOM 7300. I just put up a G5RV. Part of it is at 50 feet, somewhat horizontal. And the left-hand side is still in its inverted V shape. So I got one going all the way down, sort of to the ground, and one going horizontal for about 30 feet. And I had to tie it down to with a rope from a post also. So I'm not getting any good SWR with that one. I'm over plus 5 to plus 9, so I don't want to kill the radio. Back to you.
Very good. I understand. Yeah. I have the G5RV, but I guess it's called the G5RV Junior. So it's, you know, it's shorter. I mean, it doesn't have this real long ladder line attached to it. Seem to be okay. I use the Kenwood 440 transceiver, you know, for that. But yeah, you got the I've been thinking about the 7300 as well, but I didn't get it yet. Did you get it just recently?
I'd say I got it about 2 years ago. After I got my general, so I could actually go on HF and do something with it. And I'd been using a 150 to 200 foot long wire with an SGC smart tuner, which is pretty good, but I figured maybe the G5RV would be better. It'd be about 40 foot up. I got one part 40 foot up and one part sloping down. And I even picked up a MFJ 949 tuner. They claim that could tune anything, and it's absolutely no help at all. I'm pulling my hair out trying to figure out how to fix this problem.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sure you figure it out. This net here is a technical net, and you get on early, especially. You know, we were on from 8 o'clock. There's a bunch of guys that are familiar with a lot of. A lot of the problems that you're talking about, they can give you all kinds of ideas. You know, they're very helpful. So, okay, I just talked myself out for over, I don't know, about 40 minutes or so. So I'm going to go get a drink and call it a night. But, again, we're here every Sunday night, like since the 1980s, you know. not me, but, you know, I mean, that has been going on that long. As far as all the different repeaters that you're hearing, I don't know how many different repeaters they're linked to 440 or whatever it is. Sure. I know Roy has a streaming through the computers. You can get on Echo Link and, but very good. I'm glad you could get into the repeater directly. That's great. Back to you, Lou. I have KD2 SEP, Sierra Echo Papa. This is WS2N.
All right, Paul, go get something to drink. You do sound kind of dry. at all. But just give me your call sign one more time, a little bit slow. I think it was WSY.
Yeah, Whiskey Sierra 2 November. WS2N. Back to you, Lou.
I believe you said W.